Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HOURENERGY.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HOURENERGY.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
Welcome to the Edge of Sports Podcast. I'm Dave Zirin. This week we are speaking to one of my favorite folks. His name is Ben Carrington. He's a professor of sociology and journalism at the Annenberg School at the University of Southern California, aka USC, and the author of Race, Sports, and Politics, The Sporting Black Diaspora. He is going to talk to us about USC, college football, and the recent $150 million hiring of Lincoln Riley, the new football coach. Cannot wait for this conversation. Also, I've got some choice words about the NBA looking like hypocrites on questions of social justice. I've got Jake's takes. I got the Just Stand Up and Just Sit Down awards. I got Kaepernick Watch. I got more. So please stick around and let's speak to Professor Ben Carrington. Lincoln Riley, USC. The contract details, $110 million, $6 million home in L.A., unlimited use of the private jet 24-7 for family. What's the reaction been on campus in your circles to the hiring of Lincoln Riley?
Well, it depends which circles we're talking about. So within the faculty as a whole and the staff, I think there was dismay, if I'm honest, a sense. I mean, you have to remember, as with many universities, like USC has spent the past effectively 18 months trying to get itself out of a massive financial hole. The economic impact of COVID hit the university to the tune of about $300 million, which is huge. You know, that's a huge sum of money. And so we had to lay off staff. Staff were laid off. So to be fair to university, it did as much as it possibly could to keep the staff on furlough for as long as it could. But it came to a point where staff were laid off. You know, so the staff that work in cafeterias, you know, the fairly low paid staff, if there's nobody on campus, there comes a point at which, you know, they're not doing any work. And university said, you know what, we can't continue to employ you. Faculty had a pay freeze, which in this environment is effectively a pay cut, and contributions to our pensions were suspended, which anyone who knows a bit about pensions and math is, if you don't have any contributions to your pension for a year, the compound effect of that over time is huge. So the university came to the faculty and said, look, these are unprecedented times. You know, we have to tighten our belts. Senior administrators took between 10 and 30% pay cuts. We're all in this together, you know, like we just have to get through this. And I think the faculty and staff understood that. Yes, we understood that, you know, we were dependent upon income, student tuition, and these were difficult financial times. And we're still in those times. And we're just kind of coming out of it now. We've managed to make some really difficult cuts. Faculty weren't allowed, my research budget was frozen. I didn't travel for the past 18 months as a scholar who travels because we simply weren't allowed to, you know. So it was basically, we have to make these really draconian cuts for the good of the institution. So to come out of that and then to hear these figures of, you know, and effectively, you know, there's at least $150 million that I've estimated that's going to replace in the head coach, $150 million over 10 years. But you have to factor in, of course, that they fired Clay Helton. So there's about $10 million just to buy Clay Helton out of his contract. You then have at least $5 million to buy out Riley from his OU contract. So you're at $15 million, even before you've got to what the new coach is going to earn. And of course, the other part of it is, which people don't talk about, is that in the last year of Clay Helton's stewardship, he was hiring left, right and centre, all of these coaches to try desperately to hold on to his job. All those coaches have effectively now been fired. So if you add in the cost of firing those coaches, who are probably on 2 and 3 and 4 year contracts, 1 or 2 years into it, the cost of now Riley's new coaches coming in, and I've counted at least 5 coaches have come in, like the sums are astronomical. So given all of that, yes, I think there was dismay, there was anger, there was almost like incomprehension about what did we have to sacrifice as faculty and staff the past 18 months that apparently within about 12 to 16 hours, the university was able to find $150 million as a way to kind of shore up the football program. So amongst some circles, dismay, anger, disappointment. Amongst others, of course, we have to admit that other people were delighted. You know, if you read some of the comments from alumni, some students, this was a great moment for USC in helping us to get back to where we belong. And as Coach Riley himself said at the press conference, when he said that he had reassurances from the Rick Caruso, who's our chair of the Board of Trustees, and Carol Folt, our president, that USC would do, quote, anything and everything to put USC back to where it belongs. Now, I'm not sure if there's any other part of the university, even the medical school, the law school, College of Liberal Arts, where if the dean went to the president and said, we're going to do everything and anything, like a blank check, whatever it takes to become number one, they say, well, within reason, they'd say, of course, we want to strive to be the best. But it's interesting, basically, that the message that he was given, that he conveyed, was whatever it takes, we're going to do to put USC as being the number one football program in the country. And so I think there's shock would be another way to say it. I think that the size of the investment was quite shocking, given where we are economically as an institution.
What is their justification for doing this? I mean, particularly, what could possibly be their economic justification for doing this? And in your mind, does that argument have any currency?
If you speak to some of the senior administrators, they will say to you that this is a bet, this is a gamble. I actually have some sympathy for the senior administrators, and by that I mean the president and the provost and others, because they're in a tricky situation. If you look at the CVs of most university presidents, a lot of them are lawyers and engineers. If you look at their background, these are not elite athletes. Like most university presidents, we're not D1 scholarship students. In fact, they don't even follow sports. So you always have that awkward moment when you see, especially in basketball, these presidents having to sit courtside. They've got no idea what's happening. They go to these football games and there's discussions around like the D line, and routes. You just know, like, they have no idea. And for many of them, like maybe 10, 15 years earlier, they moved into administration. They wanted to build academic programs. They had a desire for scholarship and the life of the mind. And suddenly they have to pretend that they care about college sports. And you can see in the language that they use that they don't know what they're talking about. And suddenly they realize, if I don't get this right, I get fired. Like, I'm under so much pressure. And if you look at the horrendous abuse that Carol Folt, our president, and the athletics director got over the past couple of years, including death threats. I mean, we shouldn't, I would never underestimate the political pressure that presidents and athletics directors are under in these types of schools like USC for success on the field. And I actually, and when you speak to many of these people kind of off the record or privately, they'll say, look, this is a mess. They would say, I hear you, Ben. I agree. Like, we've just gone to the faculty to try to save $30 million in terms of suspending contributions to salaries and to pensions, trying to maybe get $100 million in savings. And then we've just given $150 million to replace a person who doesn't teach a single student, who doesn't supervise any PhD students. And they'll say is, look, we are under this enormous pressure. And so my response is always, well, then show some leadership. Be brave enough to do what Chicago University did in 1939 or 49, when they decided that you know what? We're going to be a university that's focused on education and research and teaching rather than trying to win football games, you know, and to say that, you know, we're going to, and the problem is when you bring up these points, they say, well, you're anti-sport. And I say, well, like, have you read my CV? Like, I research sport. I teach sports. I'm invested in sports. I've played sports. I love sports. I'm, you know, right now I'm keeping my eye on Man City versus Southampton because Southampton are down on wanting City to lose so Liverpool can win the championship game. Like, I am invested in sports. In fact, I know sports better than these senior administrators who come to me and say, well, but Ben, there's a beauty in sports and it develops character and we have to invest in it. Like, all those things are true, but you don't need a professional system at universities to produce that. You know, the very amateur model that they profess to embrace is precisely understanding the importance, but also the limitations of sports, what sports can and can't do. And so I think what you have is this idea that they feel this political pressure to kind of support the team because they're so fearful of the alumni. And then what happens is they basically get themselves into this corner whereby, you know, you either go all in or you don't. And they can't. Then at the moment, senior administrators at places like, and it's a particular category of university, I think, the USCs, the UT Austins, who are striving to be as strong as the Ivy Leagues. Mm-hmm. But they're competing with the SEC schools, the Georgias, you know, the Alabamas, who are operating on a different model, both kind of academically on the sports side. And so these kind of very strong academic institutions that are involved in Division One sports find themselves in this really tricky situation where there's a race to the bottom around things like recruiting. And they can't go kind of, quote, too low in order to maintain their academic standards. But for most of the faculty at places like, you know, UT Austin and USC, we don't give a crap about who wins the football championship. We're more concerned about Pulitzer Prize winners and Nobel Prize winners and MacArthur Genius Awards and NIH grants. And so they find themselves in a situation. So the argument that they've put forward is this, that this is a bet. They've taken a financial gamble. And the gamble is the following, that with the hire of Lincoln Riley, season ticket holders will start to come back. That the, you know, I was, as you know, Dave, I was at UT Austin for many years. I went from one Belly of the Beast to a different Belly of the Beast. And I remember going to my first football game at USC.
I might as well interrupt you there, Ben, because one of my questions a little ahead in the game here, but I'd please address it, is I was going to ask you, coming from the University of Texas, if you could speak a little about football culture at UT and do a little compare and contrast for us with USC.
Yeah, so you know, and I went to UT straight from the UK, remember, so my mind was completely blown. You know, UT Austin's football stadium holds more than Wembley in England. You know, like I say that to my friends back in England, think I'm exaggerating, saying no, like UT Austin has its own golf club, golf course, you know, all of it, baseball, as you know. And it was, for many, under DeLoss Dodds. Now, DeLoss Dodds is the archetypal modern athletics director. Brilliant, savvy, smart, ruthless, turned UT Austin into a financial beast, even though it hadn't won the National Football Championship in years. It's the Dallas Cowboys of college sports.
In so many ways.
storied history, iconic brand, doesn't win anything. And yet produces a whole bunch of money, which says a lot about sports in America and college sports in and of itself. And so going from that environment where you really realized, you know, where Red McCombs, the big power player, you know, in Texas, you know, has his name is on the business school and at one end of the football stadium. Now, what an interconnection that is, that you get to the business school is named after you and the main end at the football stadium. So I very quickly got immersed in, okay, I see the close interconnections between sports, politics, money, alumni, and the running of an academic institution. Coming to USC, it was interesting because people would talk about USC in the same way. That, you know, they're the kind of rivals. In some sense, they are. And I remember going to the first football game at USC. This is 2017. And it was a hot day in LA, which meant it was in the high 80s, which in Austin would have been a very cool day. And the stadium was about 60% full. In other words, 100,000 people, 60,000 there, 40,000 wasn't there. And I was stunned. because that would never happen at UT. Even if UT had sucked the year before and they were playing the University of wherever, southern mid-state Missouri, that no one had ever, the stadium would still be packed for opening game day. And I said, well, why is there so few people here? And they said, oh, it's really hot today. And I was like, so what struck me was like the LA and Austin are different beasts. And though USC claims has this kind of outward identity and brand, which is up there with the others, that the fan base is a bit fickle, right? If the team's not doing well, and I'm not talking about, no, I'm sure they'd be the same with Alabama and these other places, but that might mean that 5,000 or 10,000 people didn't turn up, not 40,000 wouldn't turn up. And so I quickly realized that there was a mismatch between the image and the brand of USC and where the program was actually at, and also the fan base. And that kind of then circles back to the question you asked me before, Dave, which is the argument is that we're invest, and they administrators call it an investment. An investment in the football program increases revenue somehow. And part of it is that they'll go from 60,000 to 80,000 to sold out stadiums again. The alumni will start writing bigger checks. That the president has been on record as saying that within 2 years, they would have recovered the money for the contract for the coach. And within 5 years, the athletics program will be solvent again, which in of itself is amazing. What we now know actually is that there's been a deficit for at least 5 years in athletics. In other words, the University of Southern California has been cross-subsidizing athletics at a time when its performance on the field, especially football, has been going down and down, getting further into debt. And then what do they do at that moment? Spend even more money.
Yeah.
Now, if a dean of an academic program had done that, if a dean of an academic program for 5 years was running a deficit, and then went to the private and said, by the way, we've just gone and invested $150 million and we're not sure how it's going to come back, that dean would have been fired. But the argument is that there's TV revenue money around the corner. This is the big thing. And it's a gamble, basically, that there'll be more interest in the program. More people will sign up for season tickets. The fans will come back. That the alumni will start writing checks that were holding off before, and this TV money with the contracts due in about 18 months to 2 years, that this will be so big it will offset the deficit and put athletics back into a solvent position. And I'm thinking, this is what a gamble, you know. And even if this all works out, like let's just say this all comes together, that suddenly there are 90,000 people at the stadium again when it's been averaging 60, 65. Let's just say that all these really rich donors who are going to write checks to university were holding off. And part of the argument, Carol Folk said this at the introduction, the press conference, which I think is really disingenuous, and I'm sure she believes it, so I don't want to say she's arguing in bad faith, but I just think she's wrong, is that she gave an example. The example that she gave was, there was somebody who wasn't really wealthy. There was an alumni came up to her and said, I'm not super wealthy, but I've been so disappointed by the football program over the years. I've been holding off writing a donation to the medical school. But now that you've hired this coach, I'm now writing a check for $200,000 to the medical school. And I'm only doing that because you've now hired this coach. And other administrators have shared this anecdote. And I heard this and I said, please stop saying this, because there's so much wrong with this story. For one, you can't start the story by saying this person wasn't particularly wealthy and yet he has a spare 200,000. Now, true, maybe if you hang out with millionaires, like folks have a spare 200K. Like, so just the start of the story is like, even if you can use an anecdote, please use a better one. So the anecdote falls apart at the beginning where you say, average Joe writes me a check for 200K. Further, the check was dependent upon you hiring the football coach. Because part of the argument is, what the reason why the president uses his anecdote is, the argument is people start writing checks, but it goes to athletics. So that doesn't really help the university. That, in other words, those checks just go to this big behemoth. So you need an anecdote. Says, no, this isn't just about athletics. It's good for the university. And I'm thinking, if I was a president, someone came up to me and said, I was going to write a check for the medical school, but I didn't because the football program wasn't doing well. And now you've fired this coach, I'm going to write the check. I'd have told that person to fuck off. I'd have said, really? Like, your effort, like, you want to make a contribution to help fight cancer and to train the doctors, the future doctors, but you refuse to do so because we went 5-7 last year. And now that we've got a new football coach. And the other part of the anecdote, which I just thought was worth pointing out, is, given that we know what we know about his salary, as you just pointed out, Dave, that probably equates to about 1 week of his salary. So basically, we've got a donation that might cover about 1 week's worth of Coach Riley's salary as a way to justify spending what I've actually calculated is actually closer to $150 million. So, but that's the argument, that this will be an investment and somehow the athletics program within 5 years will be solvent, will no longer run a structural deficit, and then the university as a whole will benefit. Because so many people see us as associated with sports and how well we do in, you know, in the Pac-12 and trying to beat Alabama and all of the rest of it.
So Lincoln Riley said that he expects to turn over something like 35 roster spots on the team, roster churn and burn. And that's basically half a program's travel roster, 35 spots. What does that even tell us? And that news sort of went over without a blink. But what does that tell us about the business of college football at an institution of higher learning?
It's a great question. I'm really glad you brought it up. And that's one of the main things that concerns me. I mean, if really pushed about what concerns me about college sports and where we are, it's about the welfare of student athletes. Like the money thing is, you know, the size of the salaries are morally disgusting. I will say that the salary of these head coaches is morally speaking disgusting. It cannot be justified on moral grounds. But that's a separate issue. Suppose it's and it's even more problematic when it turns out that athletics has a structural deficit that's not even covering its own costs, and we're cross subsidizing an entity which is not an academic unit. Now, athletics doesn't teach a single student. It doesn't graduate a single student. It's an auxiliary, by definition. It's an auxiliary unit, just like estates is, or or public safety is, you know, or housing. And yet we cross-subsidize it to such an extraordinary degree. But putting all that aside, what concerns me is the academic welfare and the academic integrity of what we do. And one of my big concerns is that when you've told a head coach, apparently, that we're going to do, quote, anything and everything to put the program back. From the coach's point of view, he's now running that program like a professional sports system. Yeah, this is the trading. This is the, you know, this is the transfer, the trading moment, you know, where you're going to trade in students in and out. And they're not, at that moment, they're not students at all. They're players, right? And so from the coach's point of view, that makes a lot of sense. Although Coach Riley is on record, and I think you know this, Dave, earlier, of being a, no, he wants this along the lines of he wouldn't really trust a student wanting to transfer. Now, what's his motivation for leaving a program? Well, you know, obviously the obvious one response is, well, that doesn't apply to coaches. Coaches can leave programs apparently within 12 to 24 hours, you know, with a big check at the end of it. So let's not get too moralistic about looking down on these mercenary student athletes transferring from one university to another when coaches do it all the time and they get 100 million plus for doing it. But part of it was, you know, what's the motive? No, this person isn't really coming to this university because they want to be here. They're doing it for purely sporting reasons. But that's exactly what we're now doing. We're looking at this roster like it's a professional roster. We're looking at weaknesses and we're trading out certain footballers and trading in other ones. Like at that point, and this is one of my worries about the player, the portal was supposed to empower the students. It was supposed to allow the students to be active agents in moving from one university to the other. My fear is now that it's actually become a mechanism by which head coaches encourage, suggest, imply that another university would be a better for their chances of making it to the NFL. And you're not likely to get much playing time next year. So I'm not telling you to leave, because that would be breaking NCAA policies. We're not going to specifically say you have to leave here, but we're going to let you know that, you know, and I'm really good friends with the head coach over at, you know, University of wherever, and we can get you a spot there and you can be playing regularly. Now, but it's up to you, of course. It's up to you. And by the way, just, you know, we've gone into a player's portal and we're recruiting this player exactly for your position. But hey, the choice is yours. No pressure whatsoever. And then you, and with one thing, if you had one or two students move, that wouldn't be that surprising. But 3 or 4, 6 or 7, 9 or 10, 5, like once you get into these figures, that is really worrying for a system that claims to be about amateurism. No, so my response would be, let's just be honest about what we're doing here. Say this is a professional system. We're seeing these student athletes as athletes first and students second. And in fact, we're going to start treating them, trading them as if they were pro athletes. But of course, these athletes don't have representation. Now, a big part of it is that'd be one thing if that was the case. But as we know, in professional sports, there's an agent involved who's looking out normally for the player's interest, although we could discuss whether that's really the case. But, you know, everybody else has agents and people negotiating for them, you know, and I'm aware of stories of student athletes feeling they've been pressured to move. And that is an absolute disgrace, an absolute moral disgrace.
I mean, well said, indeed. Now, defenders, though, will say that the student-athlete graduation rate is higher than that of the general student body. Is that even true? I mean, that when you hear that argument.
It's not true. And, you're touching more buttons today, Dave. Okay, so, Dave the button toucher with Ben. Depending on how you say the sentence, it's either true but deeply misleading or a lie. So let me go through both of them. So, and President Folt, Carol Folt, has twice publicly said, she said two things when she introduced the new head coach. And this was all because she was aware of the backlash, the pushback. So part of it is the need to say, look, this sounds like a lot of money, but don't worry, other money is coming in from these regular Joes now writing $200,000 to the med school. Okay, so it sounds bad, but don't worry, other money's coming in. And the second part of it is, of course, you know, of the importance of being a student athlete. And did you know that the student athlete graduation rate is actually higher than the student population? That is not true. That is let me be generous, because she's the president. The president misspoke, or she was misinformed. Now, there are two ways in which you measure a graduation rate. The standard way in which we measure students is pretty straightforward. Students turn up on day one, they apply to University of Southern California or UT Austin or Chicago, and they turn up on week one, they're in class, and the federal government has a really clear, strict, but unequivocal way to measure graduation, and it's this. 6 years later, how many of those students graduated? That's it. You turn up, you're there, you registered. How many are there 6 years later? And they also do a four-year graduation rate. And that's pretty straightforward. And I think USC's six-year graduation rate is about 92%, which is really good. And our four-year is about 77%, which again is very good. So basically within 4 years, 77% of USC graduates graduate. Within 6 years, it's up to 92%. If you compare that to athletics, the rate would be much, much lower. But there's something called the graduate success rate. Did you hear that word, success rate? It's a slightly different phraseology. And there is, to be fair to athletics, what they would say is, look, if you use that metric for sports, it's really unfair, because basically, like, basketball would be disastrous. People that start in week one, they don't even make it to year two, one and done. They're the famous one and done. Or people might leave for the NFL early. And so, you know, they're there for 2 or 3 years, they don't graduate, but they decide, no, I'm going to declare, and I'm going to go. Or they might go to another university. They might say, you know what, I'm going to decide that my chances at USC aren't good, and I'm going to go elsewhere. So athletics departments lobbied the NCAA to come up with their own special graduation rate metric. And it's this: as long as you graduate, or as long as you transfer out in good academic standing, it doesn't count against your numbers. In other words, that, you know, you were an A-plus student, or you'd met an academic threshold, and you decided to transfer from USC to Stanford, you don't harm our numbers. Yeah, you're not a negative against us. Or if you decide to, you're in good academic standing and you go to the pros, that doesn't count against our numbers. And of course, what that does is it enables some sports to kind of have a 100% graduation rate, which is fantastic, because that's clearly, you know, that sounds brilliant. But once you look into the numbers a bit more, you realize that's only certain sports. Other sports graduation rates are still lower than USC's ones, even under the graduate success rate. And if you compare it like for like, in other words, if you say this is, because it's an unfair comparison, and even the NCAA says you should not make that comparison because it's on a different metric. When you make that comparison, certain sports drop down to like 40%, 30% graduation rates, even lower. There's a bunch of people that turn up on day one and they never finish with a degree. So I think it's, again, this will be an example where I'd say, let's just be honest about this. At no point, and athletics put out an email around this, and I And I pushed back to Athletics, and I've mentioned this, you know, to the AD, who I think is a good AD, to say, look, please stop putting out press releases in which you say the Athletics is careful. They don't lie. So they're telling the truth, but misleading. They will say the student athlete graduation rate is higher than USC's federal graduation rate. But who knows what that means? Like, unless you're like me, who, you know, and people that like know this stuff, if you just read that sentence, the student athlete graduation rate is higher than USC's federal graduation rate, you just assume, oh, it's higher. But they slipped in the federal part to cover themselves. Please don't do that. Just be honest about the graduation rates. You know, because some sports are telling a good story. And this is the thing to break down. Some sports really are doing a good job, and they are educating students, playing sports to a high level, and trying to square the circle. Other sports aren't. And one of the things I would have pointed out at that press, press conference was that the president talked about the student athlete graduation rate as a whole. Well, the key thing is football. Like, you just hired a football coach. Use the statistic for football. That will be a better one. And use the statistic that's based on the same metrics as the university. And then you get that statistic would not be used at a press conference, because it would tell a very different story. And then one other thing, and then if you look at African-American graduation, if you break that down by race, the story gets even worse. You have a disproportionate number of African-American men not graduating, or if they are, they're being transferred out. And this is one of my concerns about the transfer portal. It'd be one thing if these 5, 10, 15, 20, 30 students were transferring to Stanford, Harvard, you know, UT Austin, other equivalent universities in terms of academic, but they're not. It'd be fascinating when you try, and I've been doing this to see, okay, where are they ending up? I'm like, oh my God, these are young men who had a chance to at least come out with a USC stamped degree, hopefully. And they're now going to a place which is off them, dangling the hope of an NFL contract, which they're likely not to get. And they're going to come out with a degree from an institution which is clearly less than a USC. And I think that's part of it. That's what kind of breaks my heart, is the, you know, is what it is doing in the long run, 5 and 10 years down the line, these young men who invested so much of their bodies and their minds, and we're leaving aside the physical damage we're talking about, you know, especially in college sports, you know, to the bodies of these young men. And they at least they had a chance and would have come out with a USC degree. Now these guys going into the portal, very, very few of them are going to universities that are as good as or better than USC academically. And nearly all of them are going to institutions whose academic standing is nowhere near that of USC.
Wow, Ben, I mean, you've been in the weeds both at the University of Texas and now at USC on this issue. In a sentence, what have you learned about the business of football in your time in higher ed?
That it is a business.
It is a business.
It is a business, with all of the pros and cons of that. And the amateurism is a shamateurism is a fig leaf that just masks a brutal, aggressive, efficient system that should be named as such. And then we can deal with it. But yeah, it's and I think it's damaging to the institutions' academic credibility, their academic reputations, and that delicate balance between sports being a space for growth, for character development, for learning, and sports being this space that bastardizes those ideals is being lost. And I think what we need now is some true leadership from athletics directors, provosts, and presidents to be honest about where we are. And stop giving misleading anecdotes and statistics to support a system which is way past needing reform. And I think we're getting to the position where, you know, it can't be sustained anymore.
And one more question for you. Got to drop this nugget in here for the audience. They're unfamiliar. You're a scholar in the tradition of Stuart Hall, the great Jamaican-born British sociologist, cultural theorist, radical political activist. How does the work of Stuart Hall inform your analysis of college football?
I think Stuart Hall, to my mind, was one of the most important intellectuals of the past half century. And he had a line once about when you do an analysis, like, how do you approach it? And he says, well, you have to see how the object that you're interested in is connected to everything else. Which sounds completely overwhelming when I say to him, like, everything else, like, yes, the economics, the political, the cultural, the ideological. And I think the very best writers and thinkers at some level are always trying to do that, to see, you know, and I would say, you know, you do that, Dave, in your sports writing. You know, there's a tradition of critical thinkers who may be an academic, they may be a journalist, they may be a comedian, they may be whatever, who are always trying to say, oh, this appears like this is just about, you know, an NFL player protesting, you know, in one sport, but actually it's deeply interconnected to these wider questions, these wider issues. And so for me, the kind of what I take from Stuart Hall is that really difficult but necessary task of trying to grapple at the same time with the specificity of what you're interested in, which is why details are important, but always then trying to take a step back. The other great person that has really influenced me, and I know you, Dave, is C.L.R. James, another great Caribbean intellectual, who wrote this really important book called Beyond the Boundary. And that, I think that, you know, that title encapsulates my approach. James was interested in the game of cricket, that very English game of cricket in the Caribbean. And he writes a book called Beyond the Boundary. In other words, to understand the game of cricket, what's happening on the field, we need to understand what's happening beyond the field. And that kind of dialectical interrelationship between the wider social forces and the particular. And that's what makes, you know, thinking about sports and other topics so rich, because they appear to be very simple. As my students often tell me when they contact me after my classes, they say, Ben, you know, I took your class a couple of years ago, and they'd say, like, I have to just say, I really hate you. And I say, what, why? And they say, well, I can't just watch sports anymore. Like, there used to be a time I could just turn on the game and get a budge with my mates. And they said, I can't do it. I'm analysing, I'm thinking, I'm deconstructing it. And they say it half jokingly, but they say, like, my appreciation of sports is so much richer now because I understand how complex they really are. And I think, you know, going back to college sports, I really hope those administrators, those in charge, understand the complexity of college sports much more than they do. And see it, the other part of Stuart Hall would just be this idea of resistance, cultural resistance, the idea that another world is possible. There are some radical critiques that are too pessimistic in a negative sense, meaning that it's easy to highlight some of the flaws in sports, which is what I've just done. And one of my struggles, maybe this is what I take from Hall, is how can I make an intervention that makes things better? You know, because sometimes you'll see these athletics directors, and just one quick last anecdote, I got a phone call. I'll name who it is because they've changed jobs. I got a phone call from the former president of UT Austin a couple of years ago, or a message from his secretary saying, the president of UT Austin would like to speak to you. He read something you wrote and wants to discuss college sports with you. You know what the piece was, Dave? It's the interview that I did with you for The Nation when Patterson was being fired at UT Austin, and the president got hold of that article and read it, and then contacted his secretary to say, I want to speak with this Ben Carrington guy. And so I had a really good half an hour chat with Greg Fenves, who was the president at the time, about how he might change college sports. And he listened and he asked good questions. And I gave him Ben's radical plan for saving college sports, most of which I'm assuming he ignored and thought, well, that's not going to work, Ben. But at least it indicated to me, Dave, this is the point, indicated to me that there are presidents out there and athletics directors who recognize the contradiction. Yeah, they're not idiots. They are very, very smart people who are trying to wrestle with a really difficult thing. And I think more of us who are on the critical end and have that kind of position need to keep the conversations going with these folks. So we always make sure that the analysis is structural. It's a structural and systemic analysis. It's not about individuals. Yes, there are a few a-holes out there. Most college coaches are well-meaning people. Most athletic structures are trying to do the right thing. Most presidents, you know, are trying to do the right thing. So for me, that what I take from people like Stuart Hall and James is the idea of another world is possible, that sports is a space where we can make interventions and things can shift in a positive, progressive direction. But that only happens if we intervene in that space. And if we just dismiss it as always being like irrelevant, then I think that's an easy way out for critical theorists. Now, I think getting involved in the messy work without it being too reformist. The danger, of course, is we end up just with tinkering reforms on the side. I'm willing to take that risk, which is why I'm on the athletics council at UT, was at UT and here at USC. So I keep badgering the athletics director and the provost to kind of do the right thing, because I do genuinely believe that sports can be a force for good, but only under certain conditions. And if those conditions aren't there, sports can do the opposite.
Fantastic. and been so generous with your time, Ben. I look forward to reading Ben's radical plan for saving college sports or for changing college sports. That is a pamphlet I would read. Last question. What music are you listening to these days, Ben? What's going through your playlist as you go through life in the trend-setting mecca that is Southern California?
Yeah. I've been getting into dub reggae of late. Some old dub reggae. Lee Scratch Perry passed away. There's some real reggae dub greats, heroes, who, many of whom have begun to pass away over the past 12 months. These are people who created a new genre of music out of the Caribbean, out of Jamaica. And I think, and that dub beat, that deep bass, which infiltrates so much other popular music, but is often not acknowledged. So I've been re-immersing myself in, you know, like Sly and Robbie and, you know, a number of real, the Peter Toshes of the world, you know, real pioneers in Black Caribbean dub music that's reshaped the soundscapes, the sound systems of so much of the world. So I've been trying to pay homage and respect to that. So I'd encourage people to who aren't familiar with that music to really check out dub and roots reggae and dub music.
And Lee Scratch Perry, an absolute legend. If he's not part of your turntable, make him. Hey, Ben Carrington, you've been so generous with your time. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure. I remember being one of the first people to ask a sports sociologist many, many years ago. And so I like my once every 5 to 8 years appearance on whatever Dave Zirin is doing in the media world. So thank you so much for your work as well, Dave, and everyone you work with.
Thank you. We'll be back right after a quick word from the sponsor of this podcast, The Nation Magazine. We'll be back right after this, but first, a quick word from the sponsor of this podcast, The Nation Magazine. Okay, look, the need for independent journalism has never been more important, and The Nation brings it each and every week like they've been doing since 1865. I'm serious. This is what you gotta read. It's The Nation Magazine. Go to thenation.com/subscribe. And please never forget that when you support The Nation Magazine, you are also supporting the continued existence of this podcast. So please subscribe. Go to www.thenation.com/subscribe. And now, back to the Edge of Sports podcast. Now I've got some choice words. Okay, look. It's something only a blinkered sociopath or a billionaire hedge fund manager would say out loud. The financial titan in question, Chamath Palihapitiya, said with a shrug to fellow co-hosts of his podcast, All In, "Nobody cares about what's happening to the Uyghurs, okay? You bring it up because you really care, and I think it's nice that you care. The rest of us don't care. I'm just telling you a very hard, ugly truth. Of all the things I care about, yes, it is below my line." Look, now if Palihapitiya were just some random hedge fund manager, his comments may have gone unnoticed, or he may have been labeled just another verbose tool. However, he also owns 10% of the NBA's Golden State Warriors. The NBA, of course, has had an extremely turbulent relationship with China. The league depends on the hoops-mad country for a multi-billion dollar portion of its annual revenue, which critics say has caused the league to remain silent on China's human rights abuses, including its treatment of Uyghur Muslims that human rights organizations decry as a genocide. The NBA public relations staff has promoted the phrase Black Lives Matter, but the league's silence on China has made it a punching bag for Republicans and Democrats itching for a new Cold War with Russia, especially Republicans who hate the NBA and its players for promoting racial justice. Now, Palihapitiya saying the quiet part out loud reveals the kind of callousness that NBA franchise owners must carry in their hearts to exercise silence in the face of such injustice. Already, the Golden State Warriors are distancing themselves from Palihapitiya's comments, saying in a written statement to CNN, "As a limited investor who has no day-to-day operating functions with the Warriors, Mr. Palihapitiya does not speak on behalf of our franchise, and his views certainly don't reflect those of our organization. But while not speaking in an official capacity, Palihapitiya is giving voice to the only reason NBA owners could have for their silence, that the Uyghurs don't matter enough for them to speak up. The dilemma the NBA finds itself in displays yet again the pitfalls in self-promotional and selective justice speak. The NBA says it is committed to social justice everywhere, apparently except in China, its number one profit partner. This hypocrisy doesn't only harm the public image of the NBA, it also hurts the movement against racism that the NBA purports to support. But the NBA has more than just a China problem. Several members of the NBA's billionaire class of franchise owners have made the league look hypocritical because their business interests are at odds with the league's social justice pretensions. For example, Detroit Pistons franchise owner Tom Gorris is the founder, CEO, and chairman of Platinum Equity, a private equity firm that owns Securus, the largest prison phone company in the country. Securus has a horrible reputation for fleecing the families of the incarcerated. Then there is subprime Dan Gilbert, owner of the Cleveland Cavaliers. His company, Quicken Loans, settled with the Department of Justice over its alleged role in the subprime mortgage crisis, which, as the housing market collapsed, disproportionately emptied Black families' savings accounts. Then there is the inconvenient truth that per a September 2020 report, 81% of the NBA owners' political donations go to the party of Donald Trump, Jim Crow 2.0, and the Blue Lives Matter crowd. Of course, that's Blue Lives Matter, except for the U.S. Capitol Police. This gap between public relations performance and profit-making reality is fast becoming an Achilles heel for the entire league. Commissioner Adam Silver likes to say the NBA stands for something greater. Maybe someday he'll admit just what that something greater is. Maybe then we'll learn how many threatened human beings exist below the NBA's bottom line. We'll be back right after this with a quick word from Edge of Sports. Hey, everybody out there. This is Dave Zirin with the Edge of Sports podcast. People got to know that we put this podcast on with elbow grease and bubble gum on a weekly basis. And we're proud of the work that we do. We love it. But we can't do it without support from you, the listener. So please go to patreon.com/edgeofsportspod and support the podcast. That's patreon.com/edgeofsportspod. Any little bit you might give to support the podcast actually makes a huge difference to the work we're trying to do. That's patreon.com/edgeofsportspod. We appreciate you. Make no mistake about it. And now, back to the Edge of Sports podcast. Well, now's the time for the part of the show we call Just Stand Up or Just Sit Your Ass Down. The Just Stand Up Award this week, stand up! Shockingly and happily, goes to Nick Saban and Jerry West, two legends of West Virginia sports, who signed a letter to Senator Joe Manchin, who is also in the pockets of coal barons and all sorts of disgusting people. Joe Manchin is the absolute worst. If you don't know why, Google. Look, Joe Manchin is standing in the way of filibuster reform and actual voting rights in this country. Joe Manchin is somebody who is allowing Jim Crow 2.0 to take root and nestle throughout the United States, not just in the South. And Nick Saban and Jerry West said, no, you don't want this to happen. As my man Lou Moore said about Nick Saban signing this letter, he said, Bear Bryant would never. So yeah, people might have problems with Nick Saban. Hell, people might have problems with Jerry West for all I know. But them stepping up at this time in history in a state like West Virginia, you definitely get the Just Stand Up Award. The Just Sit Your Ass Down Award, Sit Your Ass Down.
Sit your ass down.
I could make it go to Aaron Rodgers. I could make it go to the NFL for its continuing practice of athletic apartheid. There's so many people who are being annoying right now. I don't know if it's the pandemic or what. But, you know, I'm happy just giving it right back to the person that we just discussed at great length. That would be Chamath Palihapitiya. Because to be that callous in the face of such suffering while you're this billionaire hedge fund dude, just sit your ass down. We are back on the part of the show that everybody's talking about, from DC to Buffalo and everywhere in between. It's where my son Jacob tells us who's going to win the latest NFL games, and we're in playoff season right now. We call this Jake's Takes. Jake, how you doing, sir?
I'm doing pretty good, man.
Thank you, man. Wonderful. My God. Wonderful to hear your picks from last weekend. Other than one game you got everything correct in the playoffs.
No, I went 4-2.
Oh, you went 4-2. What did you get wrong?
I got all the AFC right. Then in the NFC, I said the Cowboys were going to win and go to the Super Bowl. I got that wrong.
Yeah.
Which is what that messes up my entire NFC bracket. And then I picked the Cardinals.
Ooh.
I picked the Cardinals over the Rams. And, you know, I did the same thing like that last year. I was like, oh, football team's going to beat the Buccaneers. And then they went on to go win the Super Bowl. So, I don't know. Maybe replica last year. I could see it.
You
know?
All I have to say is
they didn't invest that much.
I practically stood in front of you and begged you not to pick the Rams over the – I mean, begged you not to pick the Cardinals over the Rams. So, you know, I think there's a lesson here about listening to Papa.
Okay.
Thank you. All right. Let's go to these games. Okay, first and foremost, Bengals travel to Tennessee to take on what has to be the most disrespected number one seed in the history of the playoffs, the Tennessee Titans. Who do you have?
The Tennessee Titans, they're getting Derrick Henry back this week. AJ Brown is going to go off. And I personally think that they are going to win. But I have to stick with my bracket, and I'm just going to pick the Bengals.
What's an argument for the Bengals winning, if you had to make an argument?
Well, Joe Shiesty has been on fire these past couple weeks. You know, Jamar Chase has been arguably the most dominant receiver in football. He probably is the most dominant receiver left in these playoffs, unless you're talking about, like,
Cooper
Kupp. A good Tyreek Hill day or a good Davante Adams day.
Mm. Don't squeak on the chair, please. My God. The rookie errors here. All right, so let's go to Joe. What you just said, I'm a little confused. You said Joe Shiesty?
Yes, Joe Shiesty.
Who's Joe Shiesty?
That's Joe B. That's Joe Burrow.
Joe Burrow. Why do they call him Joe Shiesty?
I don't really know, honestly. I mean, he's got a lot of swagger on him, you know?
Is that his nickname, really?
Yeah, I haven't heard Joe Shiesty.
Joe Shiesty?
Yeah.
That's hilarious.
Also like Joe Burr.
Okay, so even though you think the Titans are going to win, you have to stick with the bracket, and you're going to go with Joe Shiesty and Jamar Chase just lighting up the Titans.
Mm-hmm.
All right, next game. We're going to do these by AFC, NFC.
Mm-hmm.
All right, in the final eight that we're dealing with here is the Buffalo Bills traveling to Kansas City. Very tough place to play the Chiefs.
I do think that the Titans are going to win. I didn't trust my bracket, but this is different. This is a Buffalo team that's coming to Kansas City. I don't care. You know, they're not wearing their bad luck uniforms. They're coming. This is going to be a revenge game for them. Josh Allen is going to go off on this Kansas City defense. They're going to look like they're playing like week two of this season. You remember week two?
Mm-hmm.
And Stephon Diggs is going to go off. You know he's going to have a great game. And that Bills defense has been arguably they've been top three this year. They've been very good. Even without Tre'Davious White, they are an elite defense.
It's interesting. I don't think enough is even being made of the fact that the Bills played New England last week
and beat them 47-17. Like, nobody expected them to win by 30.
They had 9 drives in the game.
It's Bill Belichick.
Yeah, against Bill Belichick.
Bill Belichick.
They had 9 drives. They score 7 touchdowns.
In a row. And the first 7. And then the only drive that they didn't score on was like a kneel.
No, it was a kneel down at the end of the first half and a kneel down at the end of the second half. Other than that, they scored touchdowns.
That you can't beat that.
No.
Like, that's just insane. And if they're coming into this game that hot just like that, and you know they're coming for the rent. You know that they're coming for revenge. I mean, this is Buffalo we're talking about. And I had them go into the chip, and that it's looking good right now. I mean, both of these teams are coming in really hot. 2 really good commanding victories. Both of them scored 40-plus, so their offense are going to be lighting it up this game.
It's going to be a fun game to watch.
It's
going to
be a very fun game.
That'll be tomorrow.
Prime time.
We're doing this Saturday morning right now. That would be Sunday evening in prime time tomorrow evening.
Can't wait for it.
All right, let's go now to the NFC, where your bracket became a comedy of errors when the Dallas Cowboys got just absolutely...
They really should have won, though.
Oh, they out... I mean, other than the 14 penalties and the horrific clock management, I mean, they're the better team.
Easily.
Than the San Francisco 49ers. But, you know, one of the cruel things about the playoffs, and it is very cruel, is that once you're done, You're done. So heck with the Dallas Cowboys.
No full series, you know?
No.
No, go to seven.
No, you're done. So now we got the 49ers traveling to Frigidaire, Green Bay, to play the Packers. Who do you like, 49ers, going to play the Packers?
I really do like Green Bay in this. You know, mm-hmm. they are easily the best team, I think, in the NFC. That doesn't mean I think that they're going to win. But, yeah, Aaron Rodgers, MVP, in my opinion. You got Devontae Adams, the best receiver in the NFL, and it is even close. You know, Jair Alexander.
Is he back?
I think so. He was going to be back in, like, week 17, but then he got, like, he couldn't because of COVID, so.
Oh wow.
But I think he's going to be back this week, so having him back to a corner group with Rasul Douglas, who's looked really good, rookie corner, Eric Stokes, it's a great team.
Wow.
A great win.
You got the Packers moving on, and then in the other game, this is the game that has everybody chirping. The Rams looking red hot, traveling to Tampa Bay to play Tom Brady and the Bucks. Who do you like?
You know, Tom Brady, he's faced these guys for years, you know, like Von Miller, Aaron Donald. You know, They know each other well, very well. You know, they got, of course, Jalen Ramsey, the best corner in the league. And then on offense, you got Odell, who's great. Cooper Kupp, arguably, it's not really arguable, but he got a top five wide receiver season of all time, you know. Cam Akers back, and of course Matthew Stafford, who's looked quite good this year. Besides, I mean, he throws the ball a lot, so you know he's gonna get his interceptions. But you mm-hmm. know, 41 touchdowns, that's not nothing. And I think that they're gonna beat the Buccaneers. I mean, it really depends on if they have Tristan Wirfs. I think they're gonna have him, and that's definitely gonna make it harder for the for Aaron Donald and Von Miller to face him, because he's probably the best right tackle in football. And, you know, the Buccaneers, they are really good. I don't think they're going to have Leonard Fournette. They might. I don't think so, though. I'm pretty sure he's still on IR. And then they've had a lot of injuries. You know, Chris Godwin's out for the year. Antonio Brown said bye. You know, it's going to be really tough. And that's why I think that the Rams are going to win.
Wow. That's a – wow. So – oh, my goodness. Well, we'll talk next week about the implications of this.
Am I going to pick my championship game right now or no?
Well, we already know you've got the Bills coming out of the AFC. Who's coming out of the NFC as of right now in your mind? Is it the Packers or the Rams?
We know that the Packers choke. And we know that the Packers are going to choke. And this is going to be a Bills-Rams Super Bowl. That's going to be a really fun game. You know, Josh Allen and Aaron Donald have had their history. And, yes. Like, it's going to be a great game. Two cannon arm quarterbacks and
let me tell you something,
heavy
Jacob.
Loaded defenses. It's going to be a great game if that happens.
Well, these are some good takes. Jacob, we'll see what happens this weekend, man. Well, and thank you so much for allowing us some insight into how your mind is working with regards to the NFL.
Of course.
One last thing on the show this week before we go, we usually do a section of the show called Kaepernick Watch about the latest comings and goings with Colin Kaepernick. Haven't done too much on it recently, but I got to do a big shout out because Kaepernick Productions just signed not just a huge friend of the show, but a major influence on my life. That would be Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf, the great basketball player from the 1990s, who basically was forced out of the league for protesting during the anthem. Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf is putting out a book October 18th called In the Blink of an Eye. Now, I'm so excited about this. I don't know if it's going to be good. I don't know what. But anything that elevates Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf to me is something worth covering and worth following. And I can't wait to get Mahmoud on the show come October so we can talk to him about this. So excited about Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf's book In the Blink of an Eye. I don't know if I can wait till October, but I'm going to try. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Thank you so much to the producer of this podcast, Dave Tigaboo, who I know wanted to jump in with that Carrington interview. Thank you, Ben Carrington. for coming on the show, man. You are the best. Thank you to everybody out there listening to the show. All our listeners, if you like the show, leave a rating, do something, tell a friend, I don't know, but just, you know, these podcasts operate by word of mouth. So if you like the show, don't just listen, open your mouth. Thank you very much. For everybody out there listening, please stay frosty. We are out of here. Peace.